Hello, welcome to part two of the Bare Naked Politics end of year special with me, Julia Bell, and with satirist, director, writer and producer Jolyon Rubinstein. And together, we have been dissecting the year of 2021 in terms of sort of political events, particularly in the UK. I should say, I reckon you should listen to part one before you move on to this, because then it'll be nice and linear. In the last episode, we looked at everything that took place, or as much as possible, that took place between January and May 2021. And in this episode, we'll pick up where we left off, where we, well, I'd say we argued we argued our way from around May to December. And look, if you enjoyed Jolyon's directness in the last episode, then you will love this.
Should we take the gloves off now?
Yeah, because so far tonight,
we really held back. I was able to prove to the BBC that Boris Johnson was a pathological liar. There were dickheads everywhere, right? But don't be a dickhead. I want to say something to your listeners, which is that I actually don't give a fuck. Oh, wow. The magic fucking money tree that we pulled £24 billion from to do a track and trace system. We've been talking shit about the nature of this government for over 4 hours. Yeah.
We also shared a lot more personal insights and experiences, I think, from over the last year in this part. So I hope that you enjoy this conversation. I hope it makes you think. And I reckon it'll be really useful in catching you up on what you've just been through, which will undoubtedly get you ready for what's ahead in 2022. So I'll drop you where we left off at the end of the last episode, which, I mean, the conversations we're having, it feels like these things happened a million years ago, but it was actually somewhere in the spring of 2021. Okay, still in May, this was a busy month. We also had Dominic Cummings' testimony at the Lessons Learned Committee. And this was an event that went on for allegedly 7 hours. Mm. And if I'm honest, this was one moment where I felt like, oh my God, the sheet is being pulled away. Mm. I'm seeing behind the Wizard of Oz curtain. And the big thing about what he said was, or the thing I took away, was his aggression towards Matt Hancock.
I think that the Secretary of State for Health should have been fired for at least 15, 20 things, including lying to everybody in multiple occasions, in meeting after meeting, in the Cabinet room and publicly.
But watching the senior Downing Street advisor sit in a room and say, or the ex-senior Downing Street advisor, sit in a room and say the whole thing was basically a sham was such a grounding and upsetting moment. I mean, one thing he said was, it's crackers that someone like me has been in this position. Mm, crackers was the word that he used, referring to himself basically as inadequate and inept in his ability as someone that was driving the government's policy in the pandemic.
In any sensible, rational government, it is completely crazy that I should have been in such a senior position, in my personal opinion. I'm not smart. I've not built great things in the world. It's completely crackers that someone like me should have been in there, just the same as it's crackers that Boris Johnson was in there and that the choice at the last election was Jeremy Corbyn. And the problem in this crisis was very much lions led by donkeys over and over again.
It was strange that, the multiple sides of Dominic Cummings, you know, like Iago in Othello.
He is like Iago in Othello.
Yeah, if you don't know about Othello, you know, he's basically a guy, you know, whispering in the ears of the powerful while simultaneously disdaining them.
Yeah.
And the thing about Cummings is that what he represents for me is the core of the kind of new technocrat, which is someone who is entirely data-driven. Now, data, by its very nature, discounts emotion. And emotion is simultaneously the unifying form of the narrative that we've bought into, but also it's fascinating to watch someone, isn't it? Like, didn't you feel like that? Like, it's fascinating to watch the scales drop from their eyes when they're called out. Because that's what it was about.
But Cummings, this is the thing, I'm so used to watching Boris Johnson deny any allegations against him. You know, we're recording in early December 2021, and right now
circulating are these constant rumours of a Christmas party at Downing Street, which we'll talk about later. But Boris Johnson has spent the whole day adamantly denying any wrongdoing. And we're so used to that from the government. And then to watch the number one advisor sit and basically say, we fucked it.
Yeah.
And he listed all the ways that we were totally incompetent, totally unprepared. It was a total shambles. And he talks about, and he throws every other name under the bus.
I think there's two things to say here. So one, you have a guy who maybe has fallen a bit out of favour, grinding an axe. I think it would be impossible to look at that testimony without that partly in mind. I think it would be really naive to do that. But also, I think that a lot of these technological utopians, and I would include Cummings in this, believes that he sees failures in systems and knows how to fix them. And you know what the scary thing is? He might be right about some of these things that he's saying, because a lot of his testimony was about the civil service and the way they certain things.
It's bureaucratic. Right. He talked about how he wanted to completely re-envision Downing Street. And I want to completely strip it.
If you go to a stately home, what you'll find is two things. Huge grandeur and nothing works.
Yeah. Oh, because they don't have any money.
But this is the point, is Britain is a bit like that. Is you have these huge institutions where internally nothing is working. Cummings called out huge fundamental and chronic failures within a system. The question is that lies for all of us is whether we can take his testimony as having any validity.
Yeah.
Have I ever told you about the time that I ran into him?
Who?
Personally.
Dominic Cummings? No, tell me about it.
So, Dominic Cummings lives in East London, and I turned up in a cafe and I watched him walk in and I decided to
heckle him.
Well, I'd say abscond him, yes. And I said to him, I hope you know what you're doing to this country.
Wait, so he was still in office as an advisor. Yeah.
He put up a very clear defence, which is that he felt that
he
was doing.
He defended himself to you.
Oh yeah, we argued for about 20 minutes.
No way!
Mm. It was very upsetting for me. One, because I didn't have a camera. There's no online content to be had.
I can't drive engagement from this conversation.
It was more that I felt that I finally had an opportunity to ask the questions that a lot of people have wanted to ask.
What did you
ask? In a sort of Dale Maley kind of way. Well,
right.
It was about the way that you had, you know, let's be honest here, right? It's about the way you create factions through finding the question that splits people up. That is modern politics. Everything that I said before about connecting people and about vision is about uniting people. And that has become a very unpopular dictum. You know, it's much more about playing to your audience rather than, you know, a lot of comedians when they start on the circuit, they're basically like, find your audience, find the people you're talking to. There aren't many people who go, unite people. Because
I can't believe you heckled him on the street.
Yeah, well, what a surprise.
Well, that brings me on to the fact that in June, Matt Hancock got to kind of defend himself, because Dominic Cummings basically said...
Oh, Matt Hancock.
I know, this is, summer was
I'm
Matt
so pleased we're going to talk about him. Matt Hancock, for me, he represents the pandemic, right? For me, Matt Hancock is absolutely everything that you don't want in public officialdom. This guy is all about what he looks like, right? Now, then he became, arguably, I would genuinely say, if you think about the fact that we've gone through a public health crisis, the head of public health is arguably more important than the Prime Minister.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Did you trust a fucking word that Matt Hancock ever said? Because I didn't.
Well, this is the thing, because in this inquiry, he was essentially just spending the whole time refuting what Dominic Cummings had said. And the point of this inquiry was a lessons learned inquiry. It was a committee within Parliament headed up by Jeremy Hunt, who's a Conservative MP, but he was...
very disgruntled.
He was very pissed off. He was asking them tough questions, saying, how did you fuck up and how can we make sure it doesn't happen if/when we are confronted with an issue similar to COVID-19 again in the future? And Hancock's time was spent essentially refuting what Dominic Cummings had said in equal measure to these are all the areas that we actually should discuss. And obviously, considering Dominic Cummings had said He lied. He cared more about his image. He should have been fired 15 to 20 times. What was interesting, I thought, was that in Dominic Cummings's testimony, he said, "I'm the reason we gave up on herd immunity." It gets to Hancock's inquiry on the 10th of June. And in his account, he said, "Do you know what? I really was the one that said herd immunity isn't going to work."
So then I remember the moment around the cabinet table when I said, "We are going to have to tell everybody to stop all social contact."
Right.
And I remember thinking, this is the most extraordinary thing that I've ever said. And the Prime Minister said, "Yes, we are. You better go and tell them."
So from that alone, you then, as a member of the public, as everyone was watching these things, presented with this horrific, you know, Sophie's choice. Do I believe Dominic Cummings, the disgruntled employee, or do I believe Matt Hancock, the guy who's trying to protect his reputation as health secretary?
A word that Matt Hancock says.
So do you believe Cummings over Hancock?
Yeah, I do.
Wow.
And,
wow.
I also want to make this super clear about Matt Hancock. I believe that this man is the definition of a career politician. I found this all even more difficult because this man is now launching a campaign about dyslexia. And I'm a
dyslexic. Yeah, yeah.
I find it really strange that this man was moved out of office at the time that he was. I think that was a totally politically motivated sacking.
Well, let's move on to that, actually, because I want to talk about that. Because unfortunately for Hancock, very shortly after his testimony to the Lessons Learned Committee, the Sun newspaper released CCTV screenshots of him, I hate using this word, snogging.
He was snogging someone.
No one uses this word. But I was watching that footage, obviously leaked by the Sun initially, and I was thinking at the time, I cannot believe this is real. I can't believe it. Felt like this is something you wouldn't even see in a film or in like Veep or the thick of it,
yeah,
because it's too ridiculous. And I think the audience wouldn't buy it because no politician would do this. No politician would say, "You're not even allowed to hug and then snog someone he didn't live with nor was married to in the hallways of the very institution from which he rolled out these rules."
It's so weird, isn't it? It's a very strange feeling I have about Matt Hancock nowadays. I simultaneously despise him and feel sorry for him. I feel very, very torn about this odd, very, very bizarre man who has ended up in the most populist government, mainly because he's a massive yes man, I think, suddenly being in a position where he's health secretary during the most
I love that you make out like it's an accident, like, whoops, I just fell into this very important office.
I don't think
obviously get that role because you've asked for a position within the cabinet.
Really? Because I often think that the reason that people end up in the cabinet positions that they do has absolutely nothing to do with their expertise. So he has no expertise in public
health. Well, you say that, but then you've got people like Rishi Sunak who have a background in banking and economics, and then they end
we'll
up in
come
the
on to Rishi later.
Okay, all right.
The
let's
hero,
move on, though.
I'd argue, you know, the public hero of, I wonder who decided to have a little knock on his door and report his neighbours.
All right, let's move on, though, because in June also, your favourite news channel launched, GB News.
Fantastic.
I think at the time...
Finally on to the good stuff.
It's 8pm on Sunday, June the 13th, 2021. Welcome to the launch of GB News, Britain's news channel dedicated to covering the news that matters to you and to giving a voice to those who felt sidelined or even silenced in our great national debates. Because if it matters to you, it matters to us.
At the time that this was launched, people mocked it, right? And then there was a big, heavy commentary about how this is never going to last. No one's ever going to watch this. People will watch the first day and then they won't. And it's still going. The first question I'm asking is, have you watched it?
I've watched clips from GBUs, yeah.
You've not actually sat down and thought, I'm going to dedicate some time?
God, no.
Okay, fine. And the second thing is, as a left-wing commentator, and even you dispute that, but as someone who, let's be honest, stands from a different point of the spectrum to GB News.
Yeah.
Surely you can appreciate the people who empathise with that politic need a platform that they can watch and they can relate to.
Are you seriously saying that we needed GB News?
Did I say we or did I say people
but
who...
What does that mean? Because the thing is that if you give people hate, they will take hate. Hate has always
been... So what does
been.
GB News represent to you?
GB News represents an opportunity to vilify and to admonish
you.
The most... No, I would not say me at all. I think it is a channel for contrarians, born of contrarians, for contrarians. And there will always be people who support the bully in the playground. And the fact that Andrew Neil, who decided to flagship the entire idea of this channel, then described it himself as UKIP TV.
Well, I had always made it clear it wouldn't be a British Fox News. And I think you could do something different without going anywhere near Fox. Fox deals in untruths. It deals in conspiracy theories. And it deals in fake news. And that's not my kind of journalism. And I would never have set out to do that.
Is that why you've left?
I'll let you draw your own conclusions as to why I'm here tonight and not with GB News. The differences were such that the direction they were going in was not the direction that I had outlined. It was not the direction that I had envisaged for the channel. But I was in minority of one. So it's doing what it's doing, and it's up to them. Good luck to them if that's what they want to do.
It is testament to what it is. But the other thing is, it has not been a success in this country. It has not been a success.
Well, it depends how you define success. It has its audience.
But I go back to what I said very, very early on in this podcast. I believe that Britain is in the midst of a deeply coercive, deeply disturbing level of grooming and coordinated mass hate that is similar to the hatred that George Orwell tried to point to in 1984. It was like the 1 minute hate of certain figures, and that sates us somehow. It takes away our vengeful anger for other groups, and it gives it direction. But ultimately, the narrative of the news is dictated by those who you allow a platform for. And I guess initially that was Andrew Neil, and now it's Nigel Farage.
Yeah.
And I think their political credo is very clear.
Okay, let's move into August. I mean, obviously the summer is usually, as far as British politics is concerned,
eat out to help out.
That was last year.
Hey, well.
Usually the summer is relatively quiet, traditionally in British politics, simply because MPs and you know, elective representative members of our parliament aren't there. They're away doing their thing. But this year in August, we put forward a mission to airlift, quote-unquote, as many people as possible from Kabul Airport in Afghanistan. And that was after there was this new change of tact to essentially remove any presence from the country.
I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
The West could not continue this U.S.-led mission, a mission conceived and executed in support and defense of America, without American logistics, without US air power, and without American might.
And it did completely coincide with a total Taliban takeover.
The Taliban is in control of Afghanistan. The country's president has fled, and Western countries are scrambling to get people out.
The British military are trying to move thousands of people out of Afghanistan in just days. It's a humanitarian mission in what feels like a war zone. We've watched as thousands converged on this base, threatening to overwhelm the whole evacuation.
When you saw that footage of people hanging on to, you know, literally hanging onto the wheels of airplanes and people desperately trying to climb over the walls of Kabul Airport, what did you make of it? And did you think we were doing the right thing by exiting our presence from
Absolutely
that
country? Not.
Okay.
I think this is up there with the biggest foreign policy mistakes we have ever made. We are really in danger at the moment of living in a constant deletion of our own past and our own memories of the past and our own learnings from the past. This is the country that gave Malala a platform to espouse a feminist Afghanistan. It really fucks me up talking about this. Of everything we've talked about, I think this is the gravest. I think this is far graver than COVID.
Because here's the thing, we'd had a presence in Afghanistan
for 20 years.
Decades. Yeah.
So as I said,
and it wasn't just a presence, i.e. we were patrolling and, you know, keeping the peace. It was a presence we were propping up alongside the US and other figures. We were propping up a government that by all means and by all accounts was precarious, to say the least.
I want to qualify my perspective here. My mother was a woman who travelled through Kabul in the 1970s and saw it at a very, very particular point in history. And I know that there are a lot of people who completely understandably think that just seeing some sort of Western liberalism towards women in pencil skirts as in no way representative of female rights within a country. And that may well be valid. But that was lived experience that my mother passed on to me. This is a country that has been disputed for hundreds and hundreds of years. And we decided after 9/11 with the Americans, or kowtowing to the Americans, however you want to look at it, to go into this country. For 20 years, we were involved in Afghanistan. And when I was at university, a great deal of the people that I went to university with ended up working for humanitarian organizations that furthered the cause of female suffrage in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Kabul to Helmand. These people, who I absolutely 100% believe meant to do the right thing, put people on death lists, right? Because they made them teachers.
Yes.
Because they made them
sympathizers of the Western way, right?
It's as simple as simple female rights, right? Mm-hmm. Like I don't know how else to put it. I also know people in the Foreign Office, and there is a report that came out at the time of recording that said that not only did the Prime Minister try to push for certain gentrified people's exit with their dogs, but that they didn't deal with even 5%
yeah. of 150,000
people leaving. 150,000
people
leaving.
So this is a whistleblower's allegations, bear in mind, okay? So these are disputed.
Do you know what? I don't even give a shit at this point, Julia.
I know. I understand. Do you know what? I understand
what you're saying. But I'm getting to a point in my analysis where there are certain things that I am starting to feel. And I really think Afghanistan sums it up. We are now, in the state we're in the post-Brexit, we are just our own island, we are full state. We are unable to, there is a huge cognitive dissonance in terms of the facts and the reality, and in terms of how we're able to concentrate our attention on this horrific crisis. Because as you say, when we saw those pictures of planes taking off with people holding onto the wings.
I've never ever seen anything like it in my whole life.
Neither have I. And I hope.
And this is, and like you say, we're exhausted and we're vulnerable. And this is the kind of imagery that, you know, you get used to bleakness, but fucking hell.
Let's talk about
the
politics.
And this is people who are directly suffering as a result of the actions from external states, including the UK.
Yeah, this is really important because 6 months before this took place, Donald Trump decided to release Taliban prisoners who were the most senior members of the Taliban. And at the time, we were not paying attention. And I don't blame us for that. We're not responsible for the actions of this superpower, but we are innately linked to it. And this, for me, has been the running narrative. What I've been trying to say to you is it's not some fucking hopeful utopian left-wing thing. It's simple, basic humanity and responsibility for the actions that we've taken. Now, Britain, returning to my first quote from George Orwell, is a family with a lot of skeletons in the closet. Now, whether we want to...
Afghanistan is a big one, right?
Well, Afghanistan is a huge one, but it's not the only one. And yet, as soon as it's outside the nation state, we are simply ignoring our responsibility.
Yeah.
And I don't mean you and me, and I don't mean anyone that's listening. I mean very, very clearly the British government, because Dominic Raab, at the time when this was happening...
He was the Foreign Secretary.
...was on holiday. Now, I don't care what anyone says about the fact that he was able to answer his phone. He evidently did not answer his phone.
And I think it's important to touch on this. At the time of recording, it's December, and we've just had reports, as of the last couple of days, from a whistleblower who was within the Foreign Office at the time that Dominic Raab was the Foreign Secretary. And he has, you know, essentially given this 40-page and the rest... testimony about allegations and accusations that are kind of unspeakable, and if any slash all of them are true, it's outrageous to do with this Kabul airport airlift mission. One of the key accusations, like Jolyon just mentioned, was that only 5% of the 150,000 people who needed help actually got any. Another of the allegations was that dogs and cats were given more priority than humans. Again, Joel referenced that. But another key one was that Dominic Raab didn't have any real knowledge of what was happening, and he needed, quote-unquote, hours to go through the notes, i.e. the briefing documents that were given to him, presumably by civil servants, to understand the scenario before he could even make decisions. And the kind of criticism there is, as Foreign Secretary, you should be on top of this, and you should be able to make quick decisions that aren't taking hours where people's lives are at stake, and presumably people's lives could have been lost. Amongst that, you know, there were other accusations of, for example, nobody spoke any Afghan languages, or very few, yeah, within the Foreign Office. So anyone who was getting through to this sort of quote-unquote helpline was having to state their difficulties, to say the least, in English, when it wasn't necessarily their first language.
Now, this is the key point. If Brexit Britain is a country that reneges on all promises, mm-hmm, then what sort of fucking country are we becoming? Because I want to be proud of Britain in defence. I want to be proud of... I genuinely think this is what's lost of people of my ilk. If I was in charge of a political party, if I was... I don't believe that the arms trade should be disbanded. I don't believe in a disbanding of nuclear deterrence.
Think Trident should stay put?
I think people have no idea about how dangerous Russia and China are right now.
Okay.
I think that there is a necessity to have Britain stick to its commitments internationally, and we're not living in that reality. We are simply a country of ill-begotten promises, and that is a fucking joke. And I would also say very clearly that it is time that a left-centre government was able to take militarism as part of a endemic problem that we have currently in the global system, where no one works together. And if you really want to change militarism, you need to work with nation states. We are currently selling to 8 out of the 10 countries on our own human rights watch list the means of arms that has rained down on the Yemen, that has innately destroyed the basic principles that we hold in this country to be very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for that, people like myself become painted as far left, when actually we're empiricists.
I don't think on that you're painted as far left.
I think
on other things so far tonight, I would paint you as that. I think on your criticism of the Afghanistan eviction, if you want to call it that, I wouldn't say that. But let's move on. We've got half an hour. We have to get through 3 months.
Fantastic. We haven't even talked about the Euros.
Let's talk about that. Okay, moving on to October, the thing that encapsulated it for me, I suppose, was COP26, even though it started at the very end. So Halloween, prepare for another rant.
COP26.
So this was, of course, everyone who's listened to my podcast and or lived in society knows that this was a global conference that took place in Glasgow over 2 weeks, starting on Halloween, the final day of October 2021. I know you're going to say it wasn't a success. I know you're going to say that. You're already huffing and puffing. But the question I want to ask you is, was it a step?
Yeah, it was. Because I think that there is something that is happening at the moment. I would imagine that a lot of people that listen to your podcast are young people, hopeful people, people with a sense, I hope, that protest matters. And you're right. Because
Even if it's a nuisance, all
studies of protest movements is that it is an extremely, extremely small wedge that moves the dial. It's always a group of people who are an annoyance and who've got a point that is valid. Talking about the fact that the fossil fuel industry, who spend literally billions of pounds worldwide, and if you want to know more about this, please look at a podcast I made called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is on Spotify, Spotify podcast. But the problem is this. At COP26, the government had over 500 meetings with fossil fuel companies, and Boris Johnson spent less than half the conference, even at the fucking conference, right? He took private jets up and down, and in the midst of it, the Owen Paterson.
I know, we'll get to that. But fury. The fact that he left the conference on a jet to get to London for
a dinner.
But
that just shows you how little they care. And what I would say is that the hope that for me that came out of COP26 was that we are now living in the internet age, right? This is very important, Julia. There has never been a viral internet party in the United Kingdom, but there has been in Argentina, in France, in the Dominican Republic, in Brazil. New parties emerge. Now, you could be listening to this and be that person. I really want to say that to this audience, because you are our hope and you are our salvation. The truth is that it's impossible to give up on this generation who are coming through and who, let me tell you, because I've spent quite a lot of time with them, if you think that I'm radical, you have absolutely no idea what's coming, because these kids don't give a fuck.
But radical is, it's an emotive term. And
no,
it is. I feel like radical implies that someone's like a bit of a lunatic. When someone says like, oh, that person's radical.
But do you think I'm a lunatic?
No, I'm...
No, but genuinely.
No.
Because I actually think I'm quite grounded.
Okay. I just think... I mean, that's another conversation.
No, but...
No, I mean, I'm talking about, if you were to just throw that term out, that person's radical.
Sure.
It would make you immediately have assumptions about that person. Like, oh, I'm bringing Julia to this party just to warn you, she's radical.
She's radical.
It would make you go like, okay, fucking
so
hell. She's got pink hair. I'm going to prepare you for like, oh my God, this person. Whereas now, it's as if radical is what's needed. And therefore, amongst a certain generation, I mean, i.e. the generation that need to be radical in order to save the planet, it's almost a baseline expectation and requirement.
Do you know, so actually, idea that of quantum
word,
shift.
I feel bad about that word. I feel bad about people who are labelled with that word. Because it's like, when you're labelled radical, don't be demoralised.
I would actually go further than that. I'd say that the environmental movement are radical conservatives.
Yeah.
But that's the point, right? To conserve, to respect, rebuild.
And the irony of a conservative cabinet minister, also the president of COP26, Alok Sharma,
which is
crying.
I actually thought that was genuine.
May I just say to all delegates, I apologise for the way this process has unfolded, and I'm deeply sorry. I also understand the deep disappointment. But I think, as you have noted, it's also vital that we protect this package.
I agree. He spent 2 weeks ferrying at 3 o'clock in the morning between rooms, trying to get people to reach agreements on one tiny word in one annoyingly kind of legally worded contract. And then at the last minute, India and China both say, we can't commit to this idea of phasing out coal.
I don't agree with this narrative. So this was what it was sold as, right? India and China have pulled out, right?
Not pulled out. India and China both said, we can't commit to the wording of phasing out coal. We can commit to phasing down coal. We have to change it to that or else we're not signing. That was the last minute change.
You're right.
In my opinion, sent Alok Sharma into a state of
emotion and I think we are at a point where I think we should accept that the global leadership that we had the opportunity to take, we didn't. Because in the midst of this, the Owen Paterson affair blew up and they had other fish to fry. I think that the core point here is clear, is that we watch the Prime Minister sit next to David Attenborough without any fucking mask on, right? He does not take things seriously. He is playing to the gallery, and these are monumentally important issues for our grandchildren's grandchildren.
This is why, you know, your faith in humanity when you're saying, oh, they're going to pass this bill and it's the end of life. And I'm like, well, the next generation will
be really clear. If you've listened to me so far, I'm not a apocalyptic thinker. I just decide to hold people to a higher standard. And I'm not ashamed of that.
No, you shouldn't be.
I'm never going to be. Because the bottom line is that, you know, these lies matter. All of them. And they debase us. They confuse us, and it's a bit like being in a toxic relationship. It's a bit like not really realizing that you're being gaslit by an entire group of people who've promised you one thing and then pretend they haven't promised it to you. It's that simple. It's not particularly complicated, and you don't need to be any kind of genius or to have any political acumen to understand that you've been lied to. The bottom line is, how much do the lies matter versus how much I identify with them, like my football team. Like, I'm a Tottenham supporter. I'm never going to support Arsenal.
No way.
I'm never going to support Arsenal team.
You support Tottenham Hotspur?
The point is...
Oh, my listen, God.
I was there,
exclusive
Germany,
scoop.
I was there when England beat Germany in the Euros. It was one of the best moments of my life because I identify as an England fan.
Right?
I identify as an England fan. So, me identifying as an England fan... is football. Me being able to say, you know what, actually, Theresa May made a really good point there.
Yeah.
So I'm going to agree with that point. I don't care that she's conservative. She made a really good point.
Nuanced politics. I appreciate
that. That is the point. And the thing is that whether it's Jeremy Corbyn or Theresa May, right, whether it's Keir Starmer or Boris Johnson, I welcome progressive thought. And I think that, I hope that people take our sovereignty seriously enough to realise that that's where we're at. Because we can't, you know, there's no European community to, you know, say, oh, well, we don't really agree with that. Maybe we should go to our highest court to see if that's a good idea. That's just us now.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, because we're so exhausted and because we're so beleaguered, we've lost our agency, man. And that disturbs me.
Are you tired?
Yeah.
When you're...
I'm profoundly, profoundly tired.
Right.
I think what has happened, as with a lot of satirists, is that the worse it gets, the more opportunity I have to talk. I have absolutely not given up hope. But that doesn't mean I'm not exhausted.
Right. Moving on to November, and the thing that, for me... just embodies this month was the Owen Paterson / sleaze scandal. It rumbled on for weeks and weeks. To be honest, it's still rumbling on.
So in March.
Hang on, let me just cover it off. So Owen Paterson was a Conservative MP, long-standing and very well known within the party and in politics in general. He has been a member of the cabinet before, so he was kind of a big deal. He was suspended by the Standards Committee in Parliament for breaking the rules. And the rules that he allegedly broke, / definitely broke, were on lobbying.
As we say in the report, each of Mr. Paterson's several instances of paid advocacy would merit a suspension of several days. But the fact that he has repeatedly failed to perceive his conflict of interest and used his privileged position as a Member of Parliament to secure benefits for two companies for whom he was a paid consultant is even more concerning. He has brought the House into disrepute.
And instead of agreeing to the suspension, the government passed a bill that would overhaul the entire standards process and therefore save Owen Paterson from being suspended, but generally completely change the way in which processes are standardised in general.
We must address the grave concerns about the way in which we are held to account under our own standing orders. My amendment on the order paper today is not about whether Mr. Owen Paterson is innocent or guilty under that report. It's not about letting anyone off, stitching anything up, or any of the other accusations flying around the chamber. Today's amendment is about the process of investigations into members. And the question of whether this process must now be reviewed by a politically balanced select committee that will consider some exceedingly serious questions.
Naturally, the opposition parties say, hang on, we don't want to do this. And it ended up in the government having to U-turn and Owen Paterson resigning. But nonetheless, this entire story completely snowballed. And I think even the government and Boris Johnson just didn't quite expect for... Stop being so loud.
Sorry.
And I think even the government and Boris Johnson didn't quite anticipate how much this would snowball in the media landscape. I think really they thought that we wouldn't notice because there has been a bit of that. And actually what happened was the front pages couldn't stop talking about it for weeks.
Now, when an MP does their job, it doesn't make any news.
Yeah. That's true, that's so true.
MPs, a lot of MPs do great work.
Oh my God, I mean, my dad doesn't particularly agree with his constituency MP.
Yeah.
But, my God, have they worked together on amazing projects.
How many MPs can you even name? Like, really, right? I don't know the work that even a quarter of them do.
Yeah.
I genuinely know people
who
work...
So what are you worried about? Are you worried about the fact that this Owen Paterson scandal is undermining the concept of an MP in general?
I think where we're at right now is that he became the lightning rod for something that has been brewing for many, many, many months, which is the fact that in the midst of COVID, the people who seem to be supplying very needed PPE were often those who had a little shoo-in to someone they knew, rather than people who should be supplying stuff because of the quality of their goods they could supply. And I think it's really important to mention here that over 21,000 offers of very relevant PPE were given to the government, the same time that companies like Petfix or Matt Hancock's pub landlord, quote unquote, who, and I want to be clear about this, it's not evidence that he did anything wrong personally, but it's quite strange that a company who made 250 grand 1 year and then were given a £40 million contract to manufacture things that they'd never manufactured before. It's just strange, isn't it? It just begs huge fundamental questions.
Yeah, and I definitely, you know, the Greensill scandal where David Cameron was WhatsApping Rishi Sunak, and yes, he's not been Prime Minister for a few years, and yes, technically that means that he was abiding by lobbying rules, which state that if you've been Prime Minister, you're meant to leave it a couple of years before you start lobbying for private interest. Nonetheless, it made me uncomfortable that he was able to text people in a pandemic where everyone's desperate to say, hi, can you look out for this company's interest, thereby my interest, my financial interest. And also, you know, there are, you know, Gordon Brown being a key one, who is also an ex-prime minister, I should say, is saying ex-politicians should never be able to lobby people in power. It shouldn't even be allowed legally. But then, you know, you look at this Owen Paterson scandal. This is a man who was in an MP position. He wasn't in cabinet, so he was allowed to have a paid role outside of his parliamentary work. But was he allowed to further their interests? Absolutely not.
Well, I think the reason that Owen Paterson became such a sort of core issue was because for 2 years, a parliamentary standards commission had looked into this issue, had delivered a report, and the report was then rejected. Now, this is not the first instance of a parliamentary report coming out And then the government rejects it.
And bearing in mind, this isn't a parliamentary report, like, arbitrary. This is a cross-party body. So yeah. People in the Labour Party, in the Conservative Party, exactly. And a multitude of other opposition parties too, all coming together and democratically saying, we disapprove of this, and this is our mutual conclusion as to what should happen.
And this is really important, and I would hope that your listeners would know that most of what we've talked about, it's not really about left and right. It's not really about left and right. It's about right and wrong, right? A lot of this is moral. I think far too often we're tricked into these binary choices. And unfortunately, it's not just the case of Owen Paterson. When there was an investigation into Priti Patel's bullying of colleagues within the Home Office, an independent commission reported that it was in fact the case that she had done this. And it was rejected by the Prime Minister.
Former square around the Pritzker. That's what Bryce.
But don't we? Don't.
And
we...
then Sir Alex Allen, the man who conducted this investigation, had to resign because yeah. His entire body of work was rejected. So there was no point in him existing.
Now there is a huge problem, isn't there? Because I started this podcast by saying I would like to talk about the rising reality of fascism within the British system. Boris Johnson looks like a clown. He has messy hair and he acts like a total doofus. But he may be the most dangerous politician we've ever had, because if we're tricked by this, when empirical evidence shows us that any number of situations have occurred where independent bodies presented research to him and he's rejected them, then, you know, we're on a very slippery slope here. And history shows us that, you know, all dictatorships start from these very, let's just say, non-sort of nuclear points where it's terrible, but things go on. I think there is a problem in a systemic issue here where a COBRA does not have the teeth to regulate who takes second jobs and whether those second jobs can be delineated between ones that are of public service. I would give an example. So working in a GP salary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or ones that are, for instance, working for the Saudi Arabian government. Right. I think there are clear distinctions.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that the thing is that even, you know, weeks after, you know, this scandal, Tory MPs were taking jobs, working for Ghanaian interests who had interest in gas and coal and the exploration of fossil fuels. Now, this is not about if you vote Labour or you vote Conservative. This is about, do they work for us on a salary of less than 70k a year?
Or it's 80k a year. It's 80k.
Tax deductible.
Okay.
Right? 70.
But expenses.
Gross.
Expenses,
right?
Are lovely. They, sure. Even, they even get money to redecorate their offices. That's a lovely...
dock ponds.
Joel, I've seen your office. You would love that.
I would love a dock pond.
Basic IKEA office.
How dare you? Julia Bell. Forensic. I can see Julia with two years' time. Byline on The Spectator. No pink hair.
You were aggressively against The Spectator, though, because they...
Yeah, I despise The Spectator.
What do they call you? A lazy commentary on politics?
They did, yeah. And they were probably right. Yeah. No, I think that where we're at right now as a country is... I do think that it is about people of conscience. And I do think that is not some sort of left-wing trope.
I agree.
My grandfather was a One Nation Conservative. He completely agreed with a lot of what Thatcher did. I didn't agree with it at all. But he felt that it was for the betterment of this country.
Right.
I don't believe that a lot of these people believe in the betterment of this country. I just don't.
When you're talking about these people, you're talking about MPs with second jobs that work for people.
I think that there is a undisputable link between second jobs and... I mean, it's the same in America. A lot of corporations pay politicians to tie their hands in golden handcuffs in campaign finance. We don't have that in the UK.
I think here in the UK, I have trouble with the second jobs debate. I know what you're going to say. Because we never agree. But clearly, I mean, I thought we agreed on more. And then having gone through everything, I'm like, I hate everything you ever say.
So wow. Wow, I'm so pleased I agreed to do this podcast.
My attitude towards second jobs is... You have people who are leaving vocations and occupations that pay 400 grand, 500 grand, you know, lawyers.
So what?
Give me a second here. I would like to attract that talent. I would like to continue to attract that talent within the Houses of Parliament, both the Commons and the Lords. We can talk about the Lords in a second if you want. But as soon as you say you can't have a second job, i.e. Sure. you can't use your expertise to consult in legal, business, or, you know, charity matters, that would, I think, disenfranchise and potentially completely put off
okay.
great talent so from let's joining say, the industry. And yes, it's important to have people who come from a background of working as teachers or postmen or, you know, people in retail. I think it is also important to have people in there who come from a background working as a CEO for a bank, who come from a background of working in a really established law firm, not to mention the fact that these are people who have to negotiate, for example, Brexit. If we had no lawyers in the House of Commons, how the fuck are we meant to negotiate an international treaty that's meant to last decades?
I think it's a really good point. And also I'd say, because we haven't talked about this, and I really do want to talk about this, is the banking sector and inflation. Because behind a lot of what's going on right now is inflation. And it's
no, but the topic I'm talking about is second jobs.
I know, no.
So anyway, hang on.
But I'm just saying,
before do it though, do you think that MPs should have a second job? And if so, should there be a differentiation?
I would be up for, and I mean this, a quadrupling of MPs' wages. So, for instance, in places like Hong Kong, the wage for an MP is quite close to the wage for working for a FTSE 100 company.
Okay.
And there is an incentivization that public office is excellence.
Right.
And I think we've lost that.
Yeah.
So excellence, as in I represent my constituents and I am excellent.
It's not seen as a
It's not a really, is it?
And like, if
it's
you're... Kind of, you know,
I mean, Boris Johnson, you know, he put it well when he said 250 grand to do a Telegraph column is chicken feed, right? What seems rational to me is to pay people good money to do a good fucking job.
So you're saying no second jobs, but more money for MPs.
Absolutely.
Okay, I also think, and I want to make
this very clear when I say that,
mm-hmm.
is that public sector workers in this country, particularly in the NHS, who are offered a mega pay rise as 1.5%, right, is lunacy. Because
but
it's
where
not
are we
just
gonna
lunacy.
Get this money from, Joel?
Oh, wow. The magic fucking money tree that we pulled £24 billion from to do a track and trace system.
We had...
Right, so no, I think this is so
we
important.
Had to cut
Can
off,
we talk
we had
about...
We had to cut off our NHS
Did
budget.
We? Did
no,
we?
As in,
let's talk about money, Julia. No.
We only have, like, less than 12 minutes left.
Oh, Maybe another God.
Day. Maybe another day. Maybe another day. We can't. Okay, the other aspect that happened in November, or particularly peaked in November, that I think we need to talk about is this quote-unquote migrant crisis.
Oof.
And I think, you know, the moment that really stuck out for everybody was when at least 27 people drowned in one incident where a boat collapsed near the north coast of Calais.
And the French are saying tonight this is a moment of national mourning, and there has been a great deal of shock and surprise uttered by politicians on both sides of the channel. But frankly, this was entirely predictable and predicted. I spoke to someone from an aid agency last week who said that if there wasn't a change in policy, then the channel risked becoming a graveyard. And indeed, that has come to pass over the last 24 hours.
But of course, records are being broken constantly about the amount of channel crossings that are happening. So it was 1,835 in 2019.
Mm.
It's 25,776 this year.
Yeah.
That kind of jump is
terrifying.
It's
right?
crazy. So
sure.
the amount of people that are willing to put their lives at risk to make this journey across the English Channel from the north coast of France to the southeast of England. We've talked about this. I know, you know, it's pretty clear kind of how you feel about this insofar as, you know, the priority needs to be with the dignity and the human rights of these people that are making this trip. I suppose
sure.
what I want to ask you is, people are going to keep doing this regardless. Mm. Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, threatens to turn back the boats. That's what she says. And Boris Johnson says the French are the ones that need to do more. What is the solution to this
problem? I think the solution is for safe passages for people who are fleeing desperate situations to be processed in France, to be looking at whether they have indeed do have a fraternal link in this country or a promise of employment. The sad truth is that, just like with benefit scroungers, the percentage of people who are part of this problem is far smaller than the press pronounced. Because you're absolutely right when you say that the numbers have quadrupled in the last kind of 3 or 4 years.
Well, no, 1,835 in 2019, 25,000.
Sure. Germany took in a million people. I'm here to bear witness as well as talking about this as an analyst. So I went to the jungle in Calais a number of times. I met people who were vastly, predominantly middle-class people, because they're the only people who can afford the extortionate amounts that people smugglers are asked to pay. There is a core point here, which is the majority of people that I met when I went to Calais were all people, Iraqi, Afghani, or Iranian, who we had physically affected by our government's actions,
yeah,
and that were the victims of war, right? That was my personal experience. I'm not saying that is the majority of experience, but it was my personal experience. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to listen to the Daily Mail or the Sun, migrants right now are absolutely vilified in the press. So it's not really that surprising that people are terrified of these people coming to this country. I just want to remind you that Steve Jobs, the creator of Apple, was a Syrian refugee who ended up in America. Right? It's not the idea that people come here to disrupt our society rather than add to it is part of the fucking absolute nub of why we don't want these people here. It's about the idea that they destroy things rather than create things, that their culture takes away from our culture rather than adding to it.
But Joel, I agree with you on this. What I want are tangible, real-life ideas.
Okay, well, safe legal routes is not a bad place to start.
I agree. So you then know, where do we begin? Because this is the thing that I struggle with. If you look at diplomatic conversations between the UK and France, specifically Westminster and the French authorities, you have a discrepancy, probably exacerbated by Brexit. If we say, right, we need to get either people who deserve to be here, we need to get them safe passage, and we need to process those who potentially aren't eligible. We need a facility to do that. We need to nip people getting in boats in the first place in the bud. So we probably need a presence on French shores.
I agree with
the
that.
The French turn around and immediately say, and you know it better than I do, no.
No,
not
that's
doing
not
that.
Quite and right, Julia. This is a very important point here, and maybe some of your listeners don't know this. So because the French refused to declare a state of emergency in France, UNICEF, the UN, Save the Children, or maybe the charities that you donate to, they could not work in France on the migrant crisis because it was not considered to be, quote unquote, an emergency, which is why charities like Care for Calais and Help Refugees, which became Choose Love, sprung up. The only formal process that any migrant, be they economic migrant or political asylum seeker or whatever you want to call them, is facing is the gendarmes, who are the militarized French police, smashing, destroying and burning down their camps. There is zero facilitation or political will to have these people meet representatives who are capable of processing their applications. Now, this is not rocket science. This is basic governance. And we are entirely, we and the French, capable of processing their claims. The truth is,
so having
is
a kind of collaborative camp of
sure,
processing.
But
let's get to the bottom of this. So you're thinking a kind of group mentality whereby the UK collaborate with the French and have a centre on the shore of France.
Yeah, it's not difficult.
It is, though.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
It's not politically expedient. That doesn't mean it's difficult. The fact
is
that
even if you had the most liberal politicians on both sides of this divide, there would be problems.
Okay, let me explain why it's not politically expedient first and why that's not correct what you said.
Okay.
In this, in France, Marie Le Pen and the far right are extremely powerful. I don't think people understand how much the nationalist sentiment has caught fire.
So then that's the worry then. We have to collaborate, Joel, with a system which, I mean, you know, people are saying, oh, well, when Macron wins the next French election, which is happening in 2022... oh, everything will die down again. All this tension between France and the UK will die down because he's really just showing off to the French domestic audience to make a statement because we are Britain and we're, you know, we did Brexit and we're all dickheads. So really, he's just trying to show off. When the election's over and when he's won, everything will be fine. My concern is in France, they have a president. They don't have a prime minister, which means they vote for one person to take over office, sure. Different to here. And that means that he's up against... five or six different people. He's not like a two-party race there. And everyone he's up against, he's having to battle from the left and from the right, people who are saying much more strident and aggressive things than him. So maybe he'll lose, Joel. Maybe he'll lose. And if he wins, he still has to prove to all the people who voted for him, aren't you glad you didn't vote for that really right-wing person? Let me show you how glad you can be by being really tough on Britain.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you, Julia. And I want to say something to your listeners, which is that I actually don't give a fuck, right? I don't care about realpolitik in this instance.
But I'm asking if you meet these people.
I'm sorry, but this is vitally important.
But I'm asking you a question.
I said safe passage. You disagreed with safe passage.
I didn't disagree.
You asked how it could be functionally created, and yes. I tried to give you carte blanche.
I said, would it look like a collaboration between the French and
British? I don't
think
at the moment this is possible between the French and British, the French and the British government. And you're right, absolutely right, about what you're saying about the reality of the French
electorate.
So then
don't say, like, you're being too realpolitik.
We are dealing with this crisis in multiple iterations. So right now, for instance, on the Belarusian border, right, there is a bill of over 100,000 migrants, right? On the border of Macedonia and Greece, there is a gigantic build-up of refugees. A lot of this starts with the bombing in the Middle East, and it starts with people feeling that their homes were not safe.
Yeah.
I can't change that, and you can't change that.
I agree.
And there are a lot of British people who feel that they have nothing to do with this, and that is their right to feel like that. They're exhausted, and that they cannot deal with the fact that these people listen to Spotify, that they use Instagram, and they like Justin Bieber, that they have an opinion on what it was like when Harry Styles dressed up as Red Riding Hood, that they think it was iconic, that they think maybe you should eat hummus rather than Marmite for breakfast, and that they've got opinions of their own, that they speak fantastic English, and that they're entrepreneurial, right? This is the problem, is that at the moment, they're dehumanised. I have no problem with the fact this is a administrative difficulty.
That's what it is, though, John.
Sure.
And this is why I love you dearly, because you offer this insight that I don't have. I haven't been to the camps in Calais.
Right.
I haven't. I can't possibly understand.
Well, let me tell you something about going to the camps.
Okay, tell me.
Fucking learnt more about myself by realising how fucking racist I was right there. Because I thought it would cost me something. And actually, all it did was go, my God, your worldview is closed.
Mm-hmm.
This is me. This is someone who you consider to be quite far left.
Yeah.
Right? I recognise that all of the red tops that I haven't read, that they've been in my purview my whole life, have affected me on a fundamental level. And that these people are faced with the sort of challenges that when we see Olympians win gold medals, we go, my God, well done. Well done, David Walliams, for swimming the channel. Bloody good work. When a guy crosses the channel in a boat, they're our enemy. The vast majority of the problem that we have with immigration is to do with racial hatred. It's to do with the fact that they are brown, not white. And if they were white, there wouldn't be a problem. If there was a huge problem in France with white people being attacked by some sort of malign force, we would welcome them in and not fear them because they're white. All I will tell you is that the testimony that I have had from NGOs is that Save the Children, Oxfam, and Amnesty International have tried and put hundreds of thousands of pounds into legal recourse to try to create safe passage from France to Britain. And it has been seen by this government as being not expedient because it does not win votes. It does not win votes because the Murdoch press and Lord Rothermere's press has pervasively and undeniably fueled the idea that immigrants are here to steal your biscuits.
I think there's two things here. I think one, I agree.
I'm not saying you disagree with any of this.
No, I know. One thing that you've said that really hit home for me, and I want to acknowledge it and learn from it, is that I can't help but accept this concept that if, for example, this huge humanitarian crisis happened in, say, France or Germany, and there was this influx of white people, would there be this, you know, turn back the boats mentality? No, I don't think there would. And I think that's really right. And I think it's good that you point that out. The thing that I struggle with, though, is, you know, I know you hate how much I bring up these sort of practical obstacles, but I am envisaging...
Can we afford it, for instance, right?
Yeah, not even that. I'm envisaging a scenario where word gets out that Britain have set up a safe passage for people who qualify as either refugees and or migrants in distress. And I can't imagine a scenario where the north coast of France ends up completely full.
Right, the thing is that there are so many things I want to unpack about what you just said. And I want to be really clear here. Like, Julia is saying a very level-headed, very grounded, calm assessment of the current reality. The problem is that, and this has happened many times in the British press, I suppose most recently with the idea of benefit scrounging, where the public presumption, which is totally understandable if you looked at the headlines, was that benefit scroungers were taking a vast majority of our national budget when it was nothing of the sort. Mm-hmm. The migrant crisis is a very similar othering. We're being told to look at those who are most destitute and, frankly, who have the least people to defend them. And we are being told that they're the biggest problem that we face. It may sound incredibly uncomfortable for you listening to this, or you may just accept this. But the truth is, we are living in a world now, as George Orwell said, where we are a white, difficult family who are deeply uncomfortable with where the family wealth comes from and who's in charge. And the question I have to everyone listening to this is, where do you want to stand? Because when we were governed by the European Union's laws, there was some sort of get out, but now there is no get out. We are a sovereign nation and Parliament is sovereign, and we are now turning into a country that I fear that none of us will recognise in 20 years.
We're on to December, and do you want to talk about the latest allegations?
The Christmas party.
Mm-hmm. So unnamed sources have spoken about an alleged Christmas party that took place in Downing Street on the 18th of December last year, 18th of December 2020, when London, which is of course where Downing Street is, was in Tier 3, which is, of course, meant that parties were completely illegal. And for the time being, you know, for the days leading up to when Jolyon and I met up to talk about this, it was all alleged and there was all unnamed sources and you just didn't really know where it came from. But the assumption was that it was true because even Laura Koonsberg of the BBC was talking about it. And then Allegra Stratton, the sort of spokesperson for Downing Street, was caught on camera, and it's recently been released by ITV News, joking about a quote unquote fictional party.
I've just seen reports on Twitter that there was a Downing Street Christmas party on Friday night. Do you recognise those reports?
I went home. hold on.
Would the Prime Minister condone having a Christmas party?
What's the answer?
I don't know.
It wasn't a party, it was cheese and wine.
Just be clear, it's not.
Is cheese and wine all right?
No.
It was a business meeting.
I'm joking.
This is recorded. This fictional party was a business meeting. and it was not socially distanced.
And I know where you're going to go with this, but I might as well...
Should we take the gloves off now?
Yeah, because so far tonight, you really held back.
Yeah.
Well, no, tell me, you know, when you first saw that video, Allegra Stratton laughing...
Well, I'll take this back a bit, right. So, in the aftermath of the referendum, I was making a show for BBC Two called Revolting. It was supposed to be 6 episodes, half an hour episodes. And I decided... at 4:30 a.m. that, wow, we've voted to leave the EU, which I didn't think would happen.
So this was in 2016?
Yeah. And we needed to react to that, and we need to make something that spoke to that. We made a show called Brexageddon. But the point is that when you decide to, in a Sacha Baron Cohen-esque way, do a stunt on a politician, you better be sure as fuck that what you're saying is true. Because you can't stand it up to the BBC.
Right? So wait. So this sketch you did about Boris Johnson, perpetual liar...
It's pathological liar.
Pathological liar?
Right.
Was this Brexageddon?
Yes.
I just wanted to give you your book, Boris Johnson, pathological liar, everybody loves it. Are you lying right now? Absolutely fantastic. I can never tell if you're doing it or not. You're like the Donald Trump of lying. You know, you've got much better hair, though. Amazing work. Like a pathological liar. I've never seen anything like it. I really haven't. Boris, can we talk about it just quickly? I mean, did you write it? You didn't write it. You did write it, right? He's one of my friends. I was in the boiler with him. Boris!
So in 2016, I was able to prove to the BBC that Boris Johnson was a pathological liar.
That's crazy.
And I proved that.
So you had to actually prove it to a team of lawyers.
I had to prove it to a team of lawyers. Wow. I had to go and sit in a meeting with the heads of editorial policy and evidence each of my cases. I think this is where my father's job as a music entertainment lawyer was useful to me.
Because hang on. Let's
click. Point 1, point 2, point 3, point 4. I had to go through in excruciating detail in 2 different meetings. And this was just on the off chance that I'd be able to catch him. The thing is about this is that it gives me no joy to evidence to you or to myself that this man is a pathological liar. But I could evidence it then.
And you think you could evidence it now about the Christmas party?
Well, I think now it's... James O'Brien has a phrase, and it's not just his phrase. It's a phrase that lots of people have used. A fish rots from the head down.
What a lovely phrase. What a nice expression.
What a lovely, uplifting phrase for the end of the podcast.
Put it on your tombstone.
Look, I have seen independent parliamentary commissions say someone that was a terminal bully in their workplace and then be let off.
Yeah,
I've seen Dominic Raab completely clusterfuck Afghanistan and be told, it's fine, he was in Santorini on his phone. Or iPad.
Mm-hmm.
See, Owen Paterson get away with absolute fuckery and then told Jeffrey Cox was literally sitting in a tax haven advocating for them for 3 times the wage he was being paid as an MP and that's okay. People are losing faith with the basic tenets of democracy and it deeply disturbs me and upsets me.
Here's the thing though. Is this the turning point? That's what I'm wanting. No, I really wonder this. See, this is where you accuse me of having, you know, ye of little faith. I actually wonder, you know, with the sleaze scandal that plagued the entire month of November, and then just as the government was sort of coming on the back of it and saying, right, we've got to clamp back down on COVID, but we're going to be gentle, so hopefully you'll love us. And the public were thinking, well, thank fuck, I don't want another lockdown, so we like the government again. Bang! Accusations and allegations.
Well, let's be,
Christmas party come out, and then this Allegra Stratton.
I think the only way to deal with this is to deal with 2 or 3 other things simultaneously. One, was vaccine rollout a success? Absolutely. Was the booster rollout?
I hope you heard that, Conservative government.
Was the booster rollout a success? Yeah, pretty much. I'm so pleased that that has taken place. And I don't want to be this person sitting here telling you that everything that has taken place since the beginning of the pandemic or the beginning of this administration has been a total failure. That would be irresponsible.
Yeah.
However, we have a serious problem in this country with accountability right now. And the problem is this. If you do the crime, do you do the time? And I think it's very simple. No!
Okay.
We are not accountable anymore.
But might Boris Johnson? This is why you you text me, yes or no, before I met you today for lunch, a million hours ago now, saying Boris Johnson's on the way out. Yes or no? You sent that.
No, I said, what I think is that the Conservative Party is not Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson is the figurehead currently of the Conservative government.
Okay.
Rishi Sunak has been extremely invisible in the last 24 hours, and it's possible that he reported on his neighbour.
So when you say reported on his neighbour, you're alleging that potentially there's a chance...
I'm not saying anything of the sort.
No, but to get to the bottom of what you've said, you're talking about the fact that the Treasurer, which is Rishi Sunak, is based in 11 Downing Street. Boris Johnson's based in 10 Downing Street. And you're alluding to an idea...
It's horrible not being invited to a party. Right? That's all I'm saying.
Did Rishi Sunak potentially call the cops and say there's a party going on next door?
But all I'm saying is that...
You were talking about it.
All I'm saying is that when the Daily Mail start going after the Conservative Prime Minister, you have to ask yourself, what is going on?
So you think there's a... succession in the works.
Definitively a succession.
And who's the successor?
Well, I think it's quite clear, really.
So you think Rishi Sunak's our next Prime Minister?
Michael Gove or Rishi Sunak. And I think the thing is that we need to ask ourselves something fundamental here, which is that we have lived through a period of time, I mean a decade here, of Conservative rule. And rebranding is something Conservatives are extremely good at. I've known many Conservatives that I've worked with in television and in marketing. And let me tell you, they're really fucking good at this.
Okay, I mean, that brings us to the end of a year. How would you... I'm so tired. I'm so exhausted. And that's
it
just...
It was exhausting, wasn't it?
We've been here all day. It is now so dark and people are asleep.
I want to be clear about this because the record's going to be a lot shorter when you listen to it. But we've been talking shit about the nature of this government for over 4 hours.
Yeah,
I want to tell the listener.
No, but Joel, we met for lunch at 2.
Yeah. It's now 10 o'clock.
It's 11:36.
I don't want to talk about the fact that it's 11:36. It's very depressing.
I
want to be clear about this. It's really been a bad year. Like, it's been really hard for everybody.
But also, can I just say, and this is something that I appreciate about you, which is I appreciate that you don't, even though you're tired, you don't stop pointing out the shit that some people want to block from their minds. You just say... I'm exhausted by this too, but here's another thing that I want to scrutinise. And I think, and me included, and I mean this, I will, you know, for instance, avid listeners of this podcast will know that about 2 months ago, I said, guys, I actually just can't right now. And I feel like I'm getting so many questions about stuff that is so existentially terrifying. I am now taking it on as a bit of a burden, and that's not good for me. I need to just step away. And in that time, I did not watch the news, and people were asking me questions, and I was going, oh, I'm actually not across that because I don't know. Because burnout, I needed to do it. Yeah, burnout. Whereas I don't know, when's the last time that you actually stepped away?
I'm not sure that I properly have, and I probably could and should do that. For me, right now, I feel very philosophical about where we're going. Because it does feel a little bit like there's a crossroads coming, I think. I mean, it's already kind of happened, but we've got choices to make now. I think people are waking up from the madness, and it has been madness, because it was like Brexit campaign, Brexit campaign, Brexit. Fucking COVID craziness. Oh, by the way, it's Brexit. It's happened.
And it can be, I think it can be very, you must feel this more than me because you've got much more of a kind of aggressive online persona, but you, and we've talked about this before, you want to make connections with people, but once you start putting your politics online, you immediately alienate an entire audience.
Well, yeah,
and they're actually people that you could connect with if you weren't talking about politics. And there's people that I've met in person and online where I've thought, In another world where politics wasn't so prevalent, would we have been best friends?
No, probably? I'm not going to lie about this. Like, I think that the left and the right look for saying incendiary things. There are dickheads everywhere, right? But don't be a dickhead. Just have basic humility, and you will, I believe, and this is as spiritual and woo as I get, you will attract what you are putting out there. And I think also, I think this is really important. Don't give up. Don't give up. Don't give up on yourself, and don't give up on the idea that things can be better, because they can be. Because if you spoke to someone who was looking at the Neolithic people or the Roman Empire or ancient Greece, trust me, they would be saying a lot more disturbing things to you than we are. And things have got better. Yeah. They have.
Right.
So things are shit. Sure, things have been tough. But we don't have the plague, right? We don't have slavery, ardent slavery, open slavery in our societies. Women have the vote, right? These things are not a given.
The bar is low.
But these things are not a given. And people are so detached from their grandparents' history.
Yeah.
That it's really easy to forget. And I think that's
it's
where...
It's easy to forget your own agency. Like, I cannot possibly make a difference. And then I do agree that looking back in history can help reinvigorate you. Because then you can go, oh, hang on, other people have done it with way less resources and way less collective ability. Well, listen, Joel, I appreciate you.
I appreciate you
taking 6 hours of your day talking to me. I think this will be a few parts, and I think editing it will be a fresh hell. But if you want to support this
Happy
podcast...
Happy Christmas!
Jules will be spent editing it on Christmas Day. But listen, if you want to support the podcast, and if it's helped you, if it's kept you going, then please become a... Then please become a patron. I will put the details of that in the episode description as well. And that involves all this exclusive content that you can't get unless you become a part of the community, including a relatively unedited version of this podcast.
You poor, poor bastards.
Much to Joel's utter dismay, because he said some weird shit today. So it's all going to be on there. The link's there. Become a part of the community. It's a fun place to be. I thank you for listening. Merry Christmas to you. Take care. Goodbye.
Good night.